It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, part of end-of-life planning is figuring out what happens to your property when you're done. But what about all the other important non-material stuff, like your life story and the lessons you've learned? We'll hear from a rabbi and author who makes the case for passing those things on in something called an ethical will, and talk about how you can start writing your own. Now, an uptick in violent crime in cities across the U.S. has become a political issue. In primary elections Tuesday, the message from voters was mixed. Some local candidates who supported more policing had success in some races. In others, those candidates lost to people who want more police accountability. Crime is coming up in Wisconsin races, too. Here's Rebecca Clayfish, Republican candidate for governor, talking outside a Fiserv forum in Milwaukee last month after multiple shootings left 3 people dead and 21 injured in one weekend.
We need to take back control. We need to take back our streets from the violent criminals. And we need to stop catch and release policies with bad district attorneys and bad judges who simply allow the bad guys to go free and terrorize our families.
You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is crime a voting issue for you, more so this year than in the past? Are you worried about crime where you live? Are you going to vote on that issue in the next election at the local or federal level? Do you want to see elected officials take a tougher stance on crime or focus more on alternatives like funding social services? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Michael Flam is a history professor at Ohio Wesleyan University. He's the author of the book Law and Order, Street Crime, Civil Unrest, and the Crisis of Liberalism in the 1960s. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I love going back and looking at the 60s and maybe early 70s era for some compare and contrast. Can you set us up with how the law and order issue emerged as such a political issue then?
So the law and order issue emerges in the mid-1960s for a number of reasons, but one major cause is a sharp increase in violent crime. And liberals at first sort of dismiss the rise in violent crime. They claim it's a mirage. They claim that it's not really taking place. Later, they argue that to talk about crime is to be a racist. And then, you know, later liberals argue, rightly or wrongly, that the way to address crime is to attack the root causes, whether it's poverty or poor housing or bad education. In other words, more social programs. And conservatives respond very effectively, at least in the minds of many white middle-class voters, by arguing that no, what the United States doesn't need is more social programs. What the United States needs is more police with fewer restraints, tougher judges, longer sentences, bigger prisons. That's the law and order message that conservatives are promoting in the 1960s, and it really helps them.
Can you talk about how it helped conservatives politically and how it paid off?
It helps conservatives because it undercuts, it erodes the legitimacy of liberalism. It's a way for conservatives to attack the great society, the liberal social programs of John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. Law and order also enables conservatives to attack the civil rights movement indirectly by arguing that they're not opposed to civil rights, they're just concerned about this rise in disorder, this rise in crime, the way that, you know, streets, neighborhoods, cities are suddenly feeling very unsafe for many Americans.
You've looked at the idea of security as an issue for voters over the years, and that might mean violent crime. It might be concerns about social disorder. Can you talk about security as a motivating force, or at least a potential motivating force for a number of voters?
Yeah, that's a terrific and really important point, Rob. Throughout U.S. history, at least in the 20th century, it's clear that security is usually the overriding issue for voters in an election. Now, security can take different forms. Sometimes it can be about national security, during the Cold War, for example. Other times it can be about economic security, when the United States is, you know, experiencing tough times, like it is right now economically. And at still other times, security means personal security. Do I feel safe in my home, in my neighborhood? Do I feel like my family is safe? What about my friends? And so security is a critical issue. It just takes different forms at different moments.
We're talking to Michael Flam, history professor at Ohio Wesleyan University, author of the book Law and Order. We're looking at crime and law and order politicking in American elections, past and present. You can join in at 800-642-1234 in this midterm election year. Do you want to hear candidates talking about crime and or punishment? And what do you want to hear them saying? Do you want to hear calls for more police or more preventive programs, more preventive social programs? What solutions do you want to see leaders, elected leaders in particular, working toward? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. All right, Michael, now here we are, 2022. We had a long, from the, you know, kind of some crime peaks in the 80s and 90s, long-term decline in many forms of crime, including violent crime. Now, in the last couple of years, we have this increase, especially in homicide, a lot of gun violence involved in that homicide. What do you look for as you watch to see how politicians use this issue or avoid the issue?
Well, first of all, it's important to note that the rise in crime that we've witnessed the last couple of years, it's taking place across the country. It's not just in cities, it's in small towns, it's in suburbs, it's in rural areas as well. So, you know, although a lot of focus has been on some high profile incidents of violent crime in, you know, cities like Milwaukee, for example, you know, we're also having plenty of shootings and tragedies and crime taking place in small towns in Texas, for example. So I do think it's important for people to keep that in mind. What I'm seeing, it's quite interesting, is that in this election cycle, liberals are really handicapped by that slogan, defund the police, which sort of grew out of the Black Lives Matter movement a couple of years ago. And you see plenty of liberals sort of trying to sort of backpedal and distance themselves from that position, because it's created a big opening for conservatives to, you know, attack what they see as defund the police, or also what they see as, you know, catch and release. This has been a very popular target for conservatives, liberal DAs who have de-emphasized certain nonviolent issues and have really sort of, sought to limit the number of people who are being processed in the system and sent to prison.
Now, President Biden specifically criticized the defund the police message. I think it was a leaked audio soon after the last elections. He was worried that it had cost Democrats House seats, very likely. He made a point in funding, including COVID relief funding, of saying, yeah, the federal government doesn't provide most police funding, but bumping up police funding for communities around the country. Is the action of doing that something that's going to make a difference to voters? Is the perception of what Democrats think about crime more important?
Terrific point. Perception usually matters more than reality to voters. How issues are framed and presented tends to matter more than the underlying realities or statistics. In general, the federal government plays a small role in law enforcement in this country. Most law enforcement is local. And so the federal involvement is really at the margins. But I think that that's a really hard point to make. It's particularly hard for President Biden and for liberal Democrats, because in general, liberals argue that the federal government can and should play a role in trying to solve the major problems that we face as citizens and as voters. So it's hard for them to back away on this crime issue, even though technically the president's correct.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Scott is with us in Northern Illinois. Scott, hi.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Good. What do you want to bring up?
Good. At the point of it, I think the Democrats have become too progressive with the whole war. Not criminalizing misdemeanors and whatnot, but I think the Republicans have become too hard in enforcing the war on drugs. And I'm all for let's legalize marijuana, but I think we still need to maintain criminal, charges, people who are dealing it. But I think part of it too is let's lower the taxes on marijuana and let's make it more affordable so it can compete with the black market, and we can keep people out of the system that way. That's just my thoughts on it.
Scott, thanks for the call. A couple things there. First of all, is there a viable sort of middle ground position for a candidate in a time like this to take on crime, Michael?
I'm not sure there's a viable middle position for a candidate or for a politician. We've seen sort of hyper politicization in our process, and we've seen sort of for politicians, there's a lot of risk and not a lot of reward for moving to the center. You know, you want to play to your base, whether your base is progressive on the left or conservative on the right. I do think the caller makes a good point. You know, there is a middle ground here to decriminalize certain aspects of marijuana use and possession, particularly when it's nonviolent. Unfortunately, we've seen a lot of movement in that direction, and it's coincided with a sharp increase, as you pointed out, in shootings, in killings, in violent crime. And it's not necessarily cause and effect, but they're happening at the same moment. And so they're contributing to this sense in the minds of many voters that their streets and their neighborhoods have become a lot less safe.
Scott, thanks for the call. We're talking to Michael Flam, history professor at Ohio Wesleyan University, with us today to talk about how crime has shown up as a political issue in past election seasons, what it might tell us about a focus on crime in elections this year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is crime an issue that brings you out to the polls? Is it an important thing you want your candidates for any office to address, local or federal? Are you worried about crime in particular in your own community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about crime as a voting issue in American politics. Michael Flam with Ohio Wesleyan University stays with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If we surveyed you, would you put crime at or near the top of your list of issues you are worried about? Why or why not? What do you want to hear Democrats talking about, Republicans talking about when it comes to issues of crime, crime prevention, incarceration, and more? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael, it wasn't that long ago that I was talking to coalitions of conservatives and liberals who are really interested in prison reform, getting the numbers of people incarcerated down. President Trump made some cases during his term about that, made some high profile efforts to bring some people out of prison. Is that era over now, do you think?
I think, Rob, it is over. There was a moment where it seemed like politically there was an alignment. Conservatives wanted to shrink the prison population in order to reduce public spending, reduce costs. And liberals were interested in moving away from this mass incarceration model where we filled our prisons with individuals who had committed nonviolent crimes and where the United States had more people behind bars than any other country in the world. So there was this brief moment where, you know, the interests of liberals and conservatives were in alignment. But now I fear that the politics of law and order have reemerged, and the conservatives see it as a clear winner for them. And so I don't think that they're going to move to the middle ground or make any concessions to liberals.
Do you think that the politics that surrounds this actually gets in the way of solutions, of getting people together to find actual solutions for the problem of crime?
I do think that the politics of crime and the politics of law and order do get in the way of finding a compromise, finding a middle ground, finding common sense solutions. Of course, you know, law enforcement, criminal justice is not unique in that regard. We do find that, political gridlock or deadlock prevents us from moving ahead on a host of issues.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Martha is with us in Menominee. Martha, hello.
Yeah. Hey, Rob, you know, that the whole headline, you know, crime wave, it really does bring people out. It gets the base fired up. But what are we talking about? Are we talking street crime? Are we talking internet crime, white collar crime? I'm getting out to the polls because I'm going to vote against the crime against democracy. I'm not for insurrectionists running for office in Wisconsin, so that's getting me out to the polls.
Martha, thanks a lot for the call. It's an interesting point, Michael. I think people, when they think crime, they are thinking, as Martha said, of street crime often, violence, in cities, but as you pointed out, elsewhere. Other people might have other focuses when it comes to crime.
It's a great point. You know, we publicize, we politicize certain crimes. If it bleeds, it leads in the media. And the caller is absolutely correct. We could focus on white collar crime. We could focus on internet crime. We could focus on political crimes in different forms and formats here. So it's a very good point. I will say that politically, you know, it's the sensational violent crime that attracts public attention. You know, it's the violent crime in the streets, not the crime in the suites, white collar crime that tends to get the attention from the media.
Well, it's thanks for that call. That kind of visceral reaction, like we might agree that white collar crime is bad. If I wasn't the one fleeced by it, I might not feel that visceral reaction, though. We might not like the insurrection at the Capitol, but it doesn't have that "it could happen to me" element to it.
Well, that's right. And the costs of, you know, white collar crime, let's say, are widely distributed and usually relatively small for individuals. Whereas the impact of violent crime, I mean, that falls really hard on individuals, on families, communities. It's much more concentrated and much more, I would say, directly, viscerally painful for those who are affected.
Let's bring on another caller now. Kathy is with us in Madison. Kathy, hi.
Well, hi. Yeah, it's going to be an issue for a lot of people in Wisconsin. Walker and Clayfish got rid of background checks when purchasing guns when she was lieutenant governor and Walker was governor. So we don't have that in Wisconsin anymore. And anybody under 21 should not be able to purchase an R-15. That's the last three shooters, the Texas one, the Park Falls, and the cops grocery store. All those kids were under 21 with an IR-15. And I'd rather have them banned altogether, but the very least, get them out of the hands of these kids under 21. And I'm really pissed about that. So, yeah.
Kathy, thanks for the call. Michael, is that maybe a response from Democrats? Instead of emphasizing the word crime in gun crime, emphasizing the word gun and trying to hit that as an issue?
Well, it is interesting. And in the 1960s, liberals and Democrats in particular sort of for the first time raised gun control as a possible response to violent crime. It does make a certain degree of sense, certainly certain types of weapons, mental health issues, young offenders. The problem here is that most Democratic politicians, particularly those who have to run statewide, are simply scared of the gun control issue. They sort of almost view it as the third rail of American politics. It's, you know, no reward, plenty of risk, no real upside. And so although it might make sense, I don't see a lot of Democrats, at least those who are not running from safe, you know, seats or districts, really putting gun control front and center.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Michael Flam, history professor at Ohio Wesleyan University, about crime as a political issue. Back to your calls now. Liz is with us in Dodgeville. Liz, hi.
Yeah, hi. Say, I just want to say I live in southwest Wisconsin, and I think the whole defund police thing for Dems was kind of a fake issue. I think it was pertinent in a couple communities, but I think the media seized upon it. I'm the chair of the Iowa County Dems. I don't know a single Dem who wants to defund the police. I think we actually need community police who march around the neighborhood, know people, and mental health teams such as the one they have in Madison that can de-escalate people who suffer from mental illness. We already know that if we put some money into early childhood programs, such as poverty and excellent daycares and preschools, that's where we're going to get a payback. And don't have all the people with low incomes stuck in the same neighborhood together. There should be affordable housing interspersed. So it's sort of a combination, and I hate that everyone tries to make it an either-or. It's not a black or white, and I think there's a lot of common ground, but that's not how people tend to think or vote these days, and it's a shame.
Liz, thanks for that call. Michael, what do you think?
You know, it's another terrific point by one of your callers. I also do not believe that there are very many Democratic politicians who support the idea of defund the police. Unfortunately, the slogan got out there, promoted by the media, and now it's been politicized. This is another case where the perception, unfortunately, matters more than the reality. The caller is absolutely correct. We do need more emphasis on mental health. And it's true that very, very few Democrats, particularly politicians, professional politicians, endorse the slogan of defund the police, but that's the perception that's out there.
Thanks a lot for that call, Liz. Michael, in just our last couple minutes, are there lessons you think we can learn from the politics of crime back in the 60s and 70s to, again, we've got a lot of partisanship today, but to maybe overcome some of the hot button sides of things and arrive at solutions?
Well, the lesson for liberals and Democrats is that they need to take the issue of order and security very, very seriously. Because for voters, particularly middle-class white voters, that's really, really important. And they should know that conservatives take the issue very seriously, and they're going to use it whenever they can. At the same time, I want to go back to the point, moving beyond the political issue, we really do need to try to hold politicians in both parties on both edges of the sort of political spectrum. We need to hold them accountable in terms of demanding sort of common sense middle ground measures that will really address the issues of crime and violence in our society more effectively.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's Michael Flam, history professor at Ohio Wesleyan University, author of the book Law and Order, Street Crime, Civil Unrest, and the Crisis of Liberalism in the 1960s. He's with us today to talk about the role crime has played as a political issue in American elections and whether it will do so again in this year's midterms. Still time for you to share your thoughts. Email ideas at WPR.org. The U.S. House Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol plans a hearing tonight. Join us for live NPR coverage starting at 7. The committee says the hearing will present previously unseen material documenting January 6th, receive witness testimony, preview additional hearings, and provide the American people a summary of its findings. That's NPR coverage tonight at 7 here on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. We'll follow up on that tomorrow afternoon here on Central Time. And coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, if we're feeling uncertain about the economy, well, how should we manage our money? Get some personal financial advice and join the conversation with your own questions. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Sometimes it can be tough to keep up with all the hot new pop music and what's on top of the Billboard charts. But sometimes you can just wait a while and something old is going to show up again. Like this week when the Billboard Top 10 includes a song from 1985. As reported by NPR, the new season of the Netflix series Stranger Things features the Kate Bush song Running Up That Hill from 1985. Now back in the day, it topped out at the number 30 spot on the charts. But thanks to a burst of interest from Stranger Things fans, the song re-debuted at number 8 this week. Not just the U.S., the song hit the top 10 in 34 different countries. Has anything like this happened before? NPR points to Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody. It made a comeback after a famous scene in the movie Wayne's World and hit number 2 in 1992. And Dreams by Fleetwood Mac hit number 12 2 years ago after appearing in a viral video. Running up those charts, this is Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferrant. What does end-of-life planning look like to you? Maybe you think about your stuff and who's going to get what. What about all the important stuff that isn't property? Your life story, the lessons you've learned, what you want to communicate to people after you're gone? Our next guest says those words can be more valuable than possessions, and we can pass our messages on to our loved ones in something called an ethical will. It's a document you write to share with friends and family when you're gone. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you done this, or has someone, a loved one in your life, done this and left it for you? What would you put down in yours? What would be a message you'd leave behind for people if you wrote one? Do you have a question about how to do this, how it works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Steve Leader is a rabbi and an author. His newest book is called For You When I Am Gone, 12 Essential Questions to Tell a Life Story. Rabbi Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You are so welcome. I'm really pleased to be with you, Rob.
To the extent that I think of life planning, it's the will and making sure kids are taken care of and whatnot. Why should we think about the words and the messages we leave behind for people?
One of the saddest memories in the aftermath of my father's death was walking downstairs and seeing all of his stuff in a pile on the floor in the basement. And nobody wanted it. Goodwill didn't even want most of it. And there's this irony, mistake that most of us make most of the time, which is we spend so much of our time working to make money, to buy things, to leave behind for the people we love, thinking somehow the material will express our inner life, our spiritual life, our love for them, our hopes for them, our blessings for them, our life lessons. And I often say to people, that's like handing someone a picture of food. These physical material things, first of all, most of them, nobody wants. And secondly, even if they do, they can never come close to expressing and transmitting the great legacy, the great treasure you have for your loved ones when you're gone, which is your story. Your story. And if you don't tell it, it will never be heard. So this book is really a way where I can hold the reader's hand and help them tell the truth of their story, walk them through these questions that will unfold your life story. And by the way, it has nothing to do with the facts of your life, Rob. You know, there's a difference between an obituary and a eulogy. An obituary tells you the facts of a person's life, but you really don't learn much about them. The fact that I was born in 1960 in St. Louis Park, Minnesota, and went to Aquila Elementary School, you know nothing about me other than my age. A eulogy and an ethical will are about the truth of our lives, the truth we tried to live and need to articulate for our loved ones. And it serves two purposes. Yes, it will hold and comfort and guide our loved ones when we're gone. But if you go through this book and you answer these questions with vulnerability and humility and honesty, you will be holding an MRI of your inner life up to the light, and you will be able to ask yourself a very profound and important question, which is, this is what I say my truth is. This is what I say I believe is important. Am I actually living that way? Or is my life mostly kabuki?
Let's talk about timing. I will admit, I have done one of these once. The night before I went in for a very routine surgery, my odds were real good. Here I am. I'm still here. But I thought, I better put something down, leave it up on my computer screen. Last message of love for my family, just in case. Mm-hmm. You make the case that wherever we are, this is something we should probably do now-ish.
Is it ever too soon or too late to ask yourself, am I living in alignment with my truest ideals? Why wait? You know, a journalist asked me last week in the pre-launch interviews for the book, because it only came out a couple days ago, asked me one of those trick journalist questions, which is, if you had to summarize your book in two words, what would they be? And it came to me immediately. Don't wait. Don't wait, because you really never know. I didn't know my last conversation with my dad was my last conversation with my dad. I didn't know. So don't wait because you never know, but also don't wait because living in alignment with our truth, that is a meaningful, purposeful, beautiful life. I have found that the most unhappy people I know are people whose professed values and lived values are not the same. That dissonance is incredibly difficult to live with because it's a double life of sorts. So don't wait to ask these questions and tell your story and then live up to the truth of that story.
We're talking to Rabbi Steve Leder about his new book, For You When I Am Gone, 12 Essential Questions to Tell a Life Story. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story of your own to share, have you written something like this down? Did a loved one leave something like this behind for you? Do you have questions on how to do it? Call 800-642-1234. Rabbi Steve, the heart of your book is these 12 questions, and I love these because I had a hard time knowing where to start on doing this. You give some great questions. One of them, and I think this is one of those things that will inform a lot of people about who you were and what you valued, was about what makes you happy. Can you talk about that question and things you heard when you asked people about that?
Yes. So I write an essay for each chapter on the question, and then I invited about 40 people, an incredibly diverse group of people, to answer the question for themselves, and then obviously curated some of those answers and made them part of the book. And this question about what makes you happy revealed a very interesting set of common denominators. One of the things we learn when we think deeply about our own happiness is that real happiness, I'm talking about transcendent, I'm not talking about a bowl of ice cream, I'm talking about transcendent, otherworldly kind of happiness, jumping for joy kind of happiness, happiness that makes life feel worth it all, is almost always, in fact, I would say always the result of, as I say it in the book, the fruit of a slow-growing tree. Unless we really invest in something or someone, it is very unlikely to bring us a deep kind of happiness. The happiness will be fleeting. And the second thing that this question reveals is that happiness is togetherness. In other words, this highest level of human fulfillment, of joy, of happiness, is almost always something celebrated in the presence of others. And it's communal. It's part of being outside of your own particularistic needs and wants, and it's impossible to celebrate alone the way you can celebrate with your tribe, with your community. You know, I had a very interesting conversation this morning on a different NPR station, and the host said, you know, she's always heard that the Mediterranean diet has kept people healthy and resulted in longevity. And she said to me, I don't think it's the food. I think it's the fact that in that culture, generations sit together around the table. Mm-hmm. They eat together. They cook together. They celebrate together. They mourn together. They're not scattered all over the planet the way so many families are in our culture. And I thought that was a very interesting insight. There's a piece in the book that was written by one of the kids who grew up in my congregation who spent a semester in South America. And I asked her when she came back, what's different about them? And she said, well, they're much happier. They have much less, but they're much happier because they're always cooking and eating and singing and dancing together.
We're talking to Rabbi Steve Leder about his new book. It's called For You When I Am Gone, 12 Essential Questions to Tell a Life Story. He says, write it down. Leave that message. Make it available to people, your loved ones, for when you're gone. And he's got lots of question prompts to help you figure out what to write, what message to leave. Call 800-642-1234 if you'd like to join in. Have you done something like this or thought about doing it but put it off? What would you want to communicate to your loved ones when you are gone? What blessing would you want to pass on to them? What advice from your own life would you want to pass on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about ethical wills, documents you write to share your life story, to pass on to your loved ones when you die. Rabbi Steve Leder stays with us. His new book is called For You, When I Am Gone, 12 Essential Questions to Tell a Life Story. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, maybe to share a message that you hope to pass on or that someone shared with you or that you wish they had shared. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jeanette joins us now in Milwaukee. Jeanette, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Jeanette?
Well, what I want to bring up is that one of the things that made me happiest in my life was committing adultery with somebody I love very much who was also married. And we were lovers for 5 years, and I don't regret any of it, and I don't think he did either.
Jeanette, is that something you would want to share with people after you're gone?
No.
Well, thank you, Jeanette, for sharing it with us. Wow. You have one of your questions is about regrets, Rabbi Steve, and also yes. There's another about following our heart, whether it leads us in the right or wrong direction. There's a lot there.
Yeah, well, I first of all appreciate the candor. And secondly, yes, my first question of the 12 is, what do you regret? Now, she clearly doesn't regret it, and that's okay. I'm not judgmental about that. What is interesting about the regret question is, again, the common denominator, which is that what most people regret most in their life is not something they did, but something they didn't do. The opportunity they didn't grasp, the words they didn't say, the forgiveness they didn't grant, the trip they didn't take, the job they didn't quit. This is a fascinating thing because, obviously, as I often say to people, I've given up all hope of a better past, which is a very powerful way of thinking, really. It really helps people realize I've got to move forward. But we can use the past to create a different present and a different future. And this idea of opening with the first question being one about regret was very intentional because to answer that question, you have to crack yourself open. You have to be vulnerable. You have to be humble. And it puts you in the right headspace to answer the 11 questions to follow. And we learn much more from our failures and regrets than from our successes, much more.
Thanks for the call, Jeanette, at 800-642-1234. One thing you get into, and I think people probably think a lot about this either later in their lives or as they're about to lose someone, do we have to reconcile? Do we have to forgive someone who has been toxic in our lives or something we may have done, something that we've seen as unforgivable? If I'm reading you right, you say not always.
That's correct. I often, Rob, get a call that goes something like this. Steve, I haven't talked to my mother in 10 years. I text her on her birthday. That's it. Ever since I was a little girl, we've never been close. She's always made me feel terrible about myself. She's narcissistic. She's withholding, et cetera. But now that she's dying, I think I'm going to go back and I'm hopeful we're going to have a great visit because I feel like I'm going to be terribly filled with guilt and shame when she dies because I cut her out of my life. To which I respond, I doubt it. The truth is, you're more likely to be relieved. And very often, Rob, the person looks at me with this look as if to say, how does he know? Is that okay? Does that make me a horrible person? No. There are relationships in our lives that simply are toxic. They cannot be fixed. Not everything that's broken can be fixed. Not every breach can be repaired. And what that question is really about in terms of leaving a legacy for our loved ones is self-respect. That there is a point in all of our lives that is very instructive when we either have to stand up and protect ourselves or be the victim. And that's a powerful lesson for everyone to follow.
We are talking to Rabbi Steve Leder about his new book. It's called For You When I Am Gone, 12 Essential Questions to Tell a Life Story, looking at the idea of leaving a document behind, an ethical will, and that the words we leave behind for our loved ones may be a lot more valuable than the possessions that are usually covered in normal kinds of wills. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Luann joins us now in North Minnesota. Luann, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about Luann?
Well, I just wanted to say that my kids have asked me to write my story, so I have started it, and it's been rather interesting to go through my life again. I'm 71, so I've got a lot to go through.
Yeah, let me make an unsolicited suggestion, Luann, if I may. And I'm a fellow Minnesotan, by the way. Okay, so I would just try to be sure that you're not just writing a biography, that you're not just putting down the facts of your life, but also the truths that you have learned to live by and that you value and hold most dear, because that's the great bequest you can bequeath upon your children when you're gone.
Luann, thanks. Thanks so much, and good luck writing that up. I appreciate you sharing that with us. Rabbi Steve, there's a moment in your book. You get a note that prices are about to go up at the local cemetery, so you go to get your spot. And this is an amazing, even if people don't do this physically, I think this is a great visualization. You're standing there, and you're wondering, you know, as people gather for your funeral, what you wish you could communicate with them. I think that's a great thing to meditate on in some ways before writing this stuff.
It's very powerful to think about what you want your epitaph to be. And if you could stand up at your own funeral and look out at your family and friends, what would your final blessing for them be? Because then you get to ask a really profound and important question, which is, if that's my goal, am I living in a way that will take me there? If my goal is to stand up at my own funeral and look out at my family and friends and say, I love my family. You meant the world to me. I couldn't breathe without you. I'm so grateful for you. But I haven't, you know, called my sister in 3 years. Really? So are we living in alignment with the ways in which we say we want to be remembered? If my headstone, if my epitaph is going to be, as most of them are, loving husband, father, grandfather, friend, am I living that way? Am I doubling down on my relationships in this crazy hurry and scurry world of ours? So this is a very powerful exercise for today, for tomorrow, and for our loved ones when we're gone.
Did you find when you wrote this, or maybe when other people do this, that it turns out not just to be about after you're gone, but what you do between now and then? Does it actually change behavior?
Every time.
What?
Every time.
Now, I want to go practical here for a moment. I mentioned pre-surgically, I just left a note on a computer screen and hoped if the surgery didn't go well, people were going to stumble across it. On a practical level, how do we write a thing and make sure it gets to the people we're hoping to talk to?
There are a couple of ways. Not everyone is as fortunate as I am to be able to publish it in a book. but I really believe in not just the written word, but the printed word. You know, we have videos of our kids when they were little, and then we turned them into DVDs, and now they're in some dusty drawer somewhere because we don't even have a DVD player anymore. And you got to fast forward and rewind and look for what you want to find. I don't believe this should be done by video. And video, when you're talking, it's just not as deliberate. Write it out, print it out, depending upon the age of your loved ones for whom it is intended, literally read it to them. It is so moving. Everyone's crying by the end, and it is so beautiful. And then what we did is we bound it with our estate plan so that when we do die, whether suddenly or expectedly, our kids are who really my ethical will is written to my children. They will literally read that before they get to the stuff. So I'm a big believer in writing this out, reading it to your loved ones, handing them a copy, and binding a copy in with your legal will and your estate plan.
We'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
My honor. Thank you, Rob.
That's Rabbi Steve Leder with us today to talk about how to write what's called an ethical will. You can read about it in his new book. It's called For You, When I Am Gone, 12 Essential Questions to Tell a Life Story. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we may try to avoid sadness in our lives, but sometimes we may need to embrace it. That's according to the author of the new book, Bittersweet. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday with a look at the healing power of baking for our mental and emotional well-being. Plus, you get to eat some delicious bread along the way. All that and more. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up after the news, we learn how employers can attract and retain workers by helping them manage their family caregiving responsibilities. Plus, coming up tonight, the U.S. House Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol plans a hearing tonight. Join us for live NPR coverage that starts at 7. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.